This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon with practices in New York City and New Jersey.
I'm Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon, but I also do a lot of minimally invasive surgery, and I do weight loss surgery and also weight loss for medical.
So today is Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day, Marina.
Thank you, you too, and to all of our audience. We do have a great show lined up for you guys. We decided to go with the Valentine's Day feel and talk to two experts about relationships.
We have two great guests coming on. Dr. Justin Garcia is director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. He's the Ruth Hall Associate Professor of Gender Studies and the IU Bicentennial Professor, and he's an evolutionary biologist and sex researcher who consults for Match.com.
And Brian E. Cole is a leading expert on sex tech, the future of sex podcast, and she's also a sexpert on Love Honey and actually has had some recent publications, and we're excited to have her as well.
So we will be having some graphic talk on love and sex, but also on intimate violence. So please be aware if you have children or vulnerable people who are watching or listening. We also want to say that although it is Valentine's Day, it has been a really tough year for many, many of us around the world. And if you are missing a loved one from your Valentine's celebrations, our hearts go to you and we will always keep you in our thoughts.
So let's get a little bit into the news of the week, but really something that's happened since, the inauguration here in the U.S. You guys listen to Pandora or another radio station and you're like, you know, do music. And all of a sudden the ads that are coming up now are the vaccine is good. Take the vaccine. Wear your mask. I mean, the messaging around how to live in these COVID times has gotten infinitely better. And it's just amazing what a change in leadership does to generate that. But at the same time, since I hadn't really heard any messaging beforehand, I was like a little creeped out, right, Sage? Like all of a sudden, like every other message is put about, I'm like, yeah, wear your mask. It's, you know, the vaccine is good. I'm like, I know. So it's a little bit of a shock.
But, you know, I have to say it's so good when we can reach people through whatever means they are accessing information, right? Because the new variants seem to be more contagious and potentially more dangerous. And they're here in the United States as well as around the world. The B.1.1.7 variant, which is the British variant, is also here and more infectious or contagious than we formerly thought. So the CDC, which really has been publishing a great deal of vetted science since the inauguration, has really given us guidance on masks. And the gaiters are out, the single cloth masks are out. The CDC is really encouraging double masking, so that both masks fit well and the risk of transmission, even if you're exposed to the more contagious variants, is less than 5% if both people are double masked. And if you'll remember, we asked Dr. Nina Shapiro about double masking a couple of shows ago, and she made a really valid point. You have to make sure that the first mask doesn't push and open the sides of, I'm sorry, the second mass doesn't push and open the sides of the first mass. So make sure both stay close to the skin of your face.
Right. And I think it is such a nice thing that the CDC, you know, is back to being science central, right? And there was a comment made a few weeks ago or something about how the CDC lost a lot of respect in this country, where it used to be such a hallowed organization giving out really important information. We all looked to it for accuracy, and it's going to come back. The Centers for Disease Control, there's a reason they're there, and we trust them. And anyway, you guys should trust them too. But now, the other good news, in a way, is Dr. Fauci, who is the head of the National, I always mess this up, the National Institute, it's NIAID,
of Allergies and Infectious Disease.
And he's saying, which is great, and this that the vaccines should be liberalized by April. And that's mainly because I think we're going to get more Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In addition, you may have seen that President Biden did order another $200 million worth of or doses of vaccine, and he thinks that that should cover the U.S. And there was some article that I saw that also said that, you know, we have enough vaccines now to vaccinate people twice, which is, and it's not the two-dose vaccine, just saying that we have enough doses on order that we would be able to vaccinate, you know, the U.S. population twofold.
Right. I think that, if you'll recall, the goal was 100 million shots in the first 100 days, and we are actually up to 2 million shots per day. Now, it's still complicated, and I think the liberalization, as you said, the opening of the vaccines, as Dr. Fauci has said, is going to be very important. I think using local pharmacies, chain pharmacies, primary care physicians have been left out of the equation. But I think if they're brought into the fold, I think we're going to get these vaccines out. And as you said, J&J is applying for an emergency use authorization for their single shot vaccine. So, it, you know, a new day has dawned. The other thing that the CDC has done is has issued opinion on reopening schools. And, you know, that's a real issue in our country. In New York, elementary schools have been open with hybrid. In Chicago this past week on Thursday, elementary schools went back in after the city and the Teachers Federation came to an agreement. But it's really a lot of essentially common sense. Don't come in when you're sick. Wash your hands frequently. Wear masks. Keep distance. Sanitize the areas in between. Virtual meetings when needed. And there's this concept of the Swiss cheese approach where, you know, there's a lot of holes in every single aspect of protection you can use. But if you pile on 3 or 4 or 5 slices of Swiss cheese, you actually will negate those holes and you'll make enough of a barrier that the spread of contagion is really reduced. And I think we're going to talk about it again with experts on childhood health and education, but I think this is a really positive move.
Yeah, I agree. There's something else that made the news, and I think it's important as we look at vaccines that are rolling out. There's a Houston area doctor who was basically arrested. He ended up opening a vaccine vial, and once you open it for somebody who shows up, he then had 10 other doses left in the vial. And so he called around, got, you know, and his clinic was closing. So he ended up calling around to his neighborhood, and he had people waiting for him that he didn't necessarily know, but that were patients that all met the criteria to receive the vaccine. And afterwards, he did tell his, you know, he was like, look, I had these 10 doses and I ended up having to use them outside the clinic. So I took it home. I gave it to everybody. And then there was one dose left. And his wife, who also had a severe pulmonary condition, she wasn't sure if she should take it. And he was like, no, you actually meet the criteria. So he gave it to her. And then ultimately, if you the district attorney in the area, I think, got a little bit too rambunctious and ended up pressing charges against him for stealing the vaccines, even though he gave it to everybody that was in a very appropriate manner and didn't waste it. And And then the judge threw it out, but it's allegedly still going for a grand jury. Well, the problem with this is here's this guy is going in and vaccinating people as a doctor, doing exactly what was said. Don't waste the vial. Don't waste the doses. That would have been 10 doses not handed out. And what's interesting is he got arrested and he can't work, actually. He can't help other patients because until this is all cleared up, the hospitals were like, we're not having you join. But meanwhile, CVS and other pharmacies are going to be able to determine what to do with their extra doses. I mean, and they're going to create a short list. They're going to have people walk in who didn't have appointments, and they're also prioritizing their staff. So he's getting indicted potentially for something that the pharmacies already are planning on doing. That's a shame.
You know, politics and medicine just don't mix. And I think that this is a tale like that. Yeah. But let's get to our show. So we are very happy to welcome our guests. Today is Valentine's Day, and we would like to talk about love and relationships and sex. And our guests today are Bryony Cole, who is a leading expert on sex tech. She is the producer of the podcast, The Future of Sex, and she is a sexpert for Love Honey. And Dr. Justin Garcia is director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. He's an evolutionary biologist and sex researcher who consults for Match.com. Welcome to our guests.
Welcome, you guys.
Happy Valentine's.
Happy V-Day.
Yeah, I always say happy V-D, and my friends are like, Marina, you know. It's funny.
It's different valence in our communities, yeah.
Let's start with you, Justin, if that's okay. Talk to us about the Kinsey Institute. It's been around for a while. Mm-hmm. Make headlines periodically, and you guys do great research. But just for our viewers and listeners who don't know mm-hmm. the Institute, please just elaborate for us.
Sure. So thanks for that. So the Kinsey Institute is located on the Indiana University campus in Bloomington, Indiana. It's been around for almost 75 years. We'll turn 75 in April 2022. So for three quarters of a century, the Kinsey Institute has been the world's premier sex research institute. We've got over a dozen faculty working on different areas of human sexuality, sexual and gender diversity, romantic relationships, and we have a scientific research team. We also do education and outreach programs, so feel free to check out the Kinsey social media. We have a lecture series and summer institute, and then we also have a collection. And the collection is the world's largest collection of research materials on human sexuality and erotica. And we have over 500,000 items in that collection, in the Kinsey collection. So it's art, artifacts, photography, film. And then we do a bunch of research studies. The idea is that as a team, we come from all these different disciplinary backgrounds. I'm a biologist by training, history, neuroscience, anthropology, psychology, sociology, medicine, and together try and answer unique questions about sexuality and relationships and gender and reproduction and the whole gamut.
We have people watching from all over the world. Radhika checked in from Kuwait. Sangeeta checked in from Florida. Ellen Austin commented on what a difference new leadership makes. So we want to thank you guys. If you think you have friends who are interested in what we're talking about, please share and like and tag and let them know to join us. Bryony, you have looked at the tech aspect of sexuality. Maybe you can tell us what that is.
Yeah, it's a whole brand new world out there. I think most people think about technology associated with sex, and the first thing that comes to mind when you think about that is, oh, we're talking about robots, right? And through all my research over the past 5 years, I've been looking at anything beyond that, and that's sort of the challenge to think about. Yes, sex tech is sex robots, but it's also so many other things, whether that's related to our sex education systems and how we can harness new technologies to sexual health, even crime and violence reporting. How can we look at these sophisticated technologies, whether that is robotics, it might be AR or VR, any sort of mixed reality, right down to websites and apps, and how we use those technologies and deploy them for sexuality. hopefully for the better. Of course, there's all sorts of social and ethical implications involved in this, which means really the content and the discussion is endless, but the industry itself is huge. $30 billion, as you can see there, is sort of the valuation. And looking in terms of the future of sex and technology, we're looking at about $120+ billion in the next 5 years. So it's really a growing industry, not only because the technology is, you know, becoming more and more complex and interesting, but also because our conversations about sex and bringing it to platforms like this are becoming more open. And so we're getting used to that idea of technology being a part of our sexuality in so many different ways.
You know, it's funny. I think of like Sex in the City, and I think of Samantha in like sharper image or something like that. And she's standing by the massagers. And then she gets a whole crew of women. And I was like, I don't understand this. What's happening? And they're like, no, this is not just a massager. It's actually a vibrator. And I was like, oh, I get it. And so all these women were like, which one's better? It was cute. It was cute. Yeah. It was like a moment of, you know, just one of the mainstream moments of growing it. But things, tech has evolved and you know, there are things now, and especially in this time of COVID, right? Like where people were separated, they couldn't see each other. There's actually tech out there to help you feel closer together.
So many different forms of that, right? I mean, we're using video now in the most basic sense. Humans are amazing the way we just sort of adopt different things, you know, FaceTime sex for some people, virtual sex. But in terms of other technology that brings you closer to, you know, your partner, we've seen things like the use of haptic technology. So haptic technology allows you to translate a sense of touch, and that can be incorporated into, we've got pillows that transmit with a wristband the sound of your heartbeat to your lover. We've got in Japan a couple of months ago, they invented this hand. It's just a hand, unfortunately, but you can hold this hand and it feels like you're holding on to someone else. And then we have the Kissinger. So it's a kiss messenger, translates a kiss through your iPhone using different sensors. So it does have a pretty polarizing effect on people, whether or not they would actually use that. But these sorts of devices all sort of signaled this fact that we're trying to bring technology in so we can get closer and closer, and using all these different creative ideas, which, you know, eventually will fall on something. But right now, for the majority, I think it's videos. And if we want to talk about the sexual experience of that too, I think teledildonics or Bluetooth, Wi-Fi enabled sex toys, they sound futuristic. They've been around for a while. So they work pretty well. And, of course, we always come back to robots. How can robots, you know, replicate intimacy? And that raises a lot of questions, I think, about what is intimacy without its humanity. It's a minefield.
You know, it's funny because when you were interviewed for that top 10 sex tech, you said, well, robots can order pizza. And sometimes the most romantic thing in the world is to order in some comfort food and just kind of maybe truly Netflix and chill over pizza, right?
Yeah. Yeah, make me a sandwich, take out the trash. Those sorts of things are also, so you know me so well.
Yeah, so that's one of those love languages, right? Acts of service, you know? So
yeah.
It doesn't always have to be sexual. You had done a session as well, and also we want to hear from Justin, like what do you think of some of these gadgets and how they really impact, and also what you're seeing in COVID. But you had given a lecture, and I can't remember where you talked about this, pardon my friend over here walking yes. behind me. Yeah, but had given a lecture talking about this Japanese product that was sort of like Alexa for the home, but was a very adorable, avatar that was like, would turn the lights on when they know you're coming home, would send you text messages. I mean, it was really for somebody who's alone, having this as a friend. I mean, I'm sure, and Justin, you can, it raises some issues, I think, but of having intimacy and then having it with like a really an online thing versus having somebody who cares about you, show up.
Yeah, Justin, I'm not sure if you've seen Gatebox, probably is what Marina is referring to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't want to, I love this. I love hearing from Briani, the work that she's doing. And I think, because it's really innovating, it's making us think about, as we go through these steps of technology, right, we can think about how are people using text messages to stay connected? Then how are they using video like FaceTime and Skype and Zoom? And now I think we're at another point that we can see for me as a behavioral scientist, there's these questions about, we see the innovation on the tech side, particularly on the sex tech side. And then the questions become, well, what works? What works and what doesn't work? What are the ways that people can leverage these technologies? I think we hear so often that people get freaked out by the availability of some of these technologies, like the phone that you can kiss is a great example. But how do we encourage people to harness them, to make their relationships better? I myself was in a long-distance relationship for a while, and we were both scientists, and would sometimes think, okay, like, what do we do to make the relationship better, right? And it's things like, okay, well, you know, who texts good morning first, or how do we use FaceTime to do shared experiences together so that there are things that can connect the dyad? So kind of leveraging what we're learning about couples and sexuality with these technology pieces. And just one little fun piece that it made me think of, something you just said. In one of our national studies, we asked people if they would ever have sex with a robot. And 50% of adults in the sample said, a third of adults in the sample said yes. And it was a really interesting moment because all the scientists on the team were like, well, who would say no? Like, this is a new experience. This is new data. And then everyone else was like, you're all wild. But the so a third of people, adults in a U.S. national sample, said that they would have sex with a robot. And half of them, really no gender difference, half said that if their partner had sex with a robot, they would consider it infidelity. So there is something to, I think, what Briani was saying, that there's something about the sort of notion of humanity in these texts, in these technologies, about the notion of what's acceptable or not, or how far do these get pushed.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think when we talk about love and we talk about sex, but we talk about intimacy, we talk about caring. I think, you know, we opened the show by acknowledging that many of our viewers, many of our friends have experienced loss this year, and many people have spent much of the past 12 months alone. How do we recover from like that loss of either emotional intimacy or even the sense of touch? You know, there's so much that happens with just touch. So, Briani, what are you seeing in terms of how people have coped during the isolation of the pandemic and perhaps isolation after loss?
Yeah, it's so interesting talking about that sense of skin hunger that people feel is like that loss of touch. And what I've seen in my research is really a sort of two different waves, right? At the start of the pandemic, when we were all isolated and at home, we thought, oh, there was this rush to connect. Let's get on Zoom with all our friends that we can't see every weekend, or our partners. And we did what I call background Skyping a lot of the time. So we moved from those cocktail happy hours on Zoom to, I'm just going to connect with my partner while I'm going about my day. So I'm going to put my Skype, my FaceTime, my video call on, and then I'm just going to go over there and read a book or whatever. But having that sense of presence was really important. And now we're at the stage where we're extremely fatigued being on video. And so that background Skype or background FaceTime isn't actually providing us with that sense of connection that we so, so dearly want and feel like is missing. In fact, it's doing the opposite, right? So we're kind of going for quantity time instead of quality time. And so now the biggest gift I think that people want or can receive or give is the gift of presence, when you turn off everything else around you and you just purely focus on that person. We've come back to this way of like, I'm just going to sit here and connect with you, even if it is just for 5 minutes. That's a lot richer than having you on in the background and going about my day. So it's interesting the way we've sort of evolved the way we connect over virtually. And then in terms of like the sense of touch, I'm not a therapist, obviously, but I've heard different sort of tips, tricks, advice when I've interviewed sex therapists for the podcast. And one thing that was interesting that I thought was that it sounds ridiculous, but encouraging people and therapists encouraging their patients to actually hug themselves. And that sense of being able to feel a hug actually triggers different feelings inside you. I know it sounds ridiculous, but I would encourage people to give it a go and see if it works. I know for myself, I'm separated from my partner, and it's really hard to, you know, touch anyone. But yesterday I went for a massage, and that actually helped just in terms of having someone touch me. In terms of the lost question, I'm not entirely sure. I can talk about a techie far out aspect of that if you like, but I'm wondering if Justin's seen anything else around loss and grieving during COVID, the research there.
Yeah. And I think on the touch stuff, I love everything you said about touch. And it's the way I think about it is similar to you. We're a social mammal, and baked into what we see in the behavior of mammals, particularly social mammals, is touch, is physical touch, the physicality of licking and grooming, of touching each other's bodies, of holding each other, of caressing, of cuddling, of huddling. This is sort of deep in our evolutionary legacy. And it has implications for our health, for our psychological health, our physical health. So I think that we know that people crave that. In a study we did with my colleague Amanda Gesselman at the Kinsey Institute before COVID, in a national sample of a little over 1,000 partnered Americans, we found that a third, actually it was 34.4%, I still remember that stat, of partnered Americans said that they weren't touched enough by their romantic partner. So this is before COVID. A full third of people are saying, I'm not getting touched enough. That's become exacerbated now. And for a few reasons, I think it's to exactly the point you just made. Sometimes it's because you can't be around people, right? We're not shaking hands and hugging and going for massages as much or any of those sorts of interactions. But also, in some cases, because people are afraid to, right? They're worried about if, depending on what their partner does for work, should they be? And we see the environment and this sort of virus as potentially threatening. So that can tamper that down. But in fact, that's what we need more than ever. We need the close relationships. We need the hugging. We need the connection. If it makes you comfortable, not if it freaks you out. If it freaks you out, then you'll elicit fear responses in the brain. And then to the other part of that, well, why don't I stop there? Yeah.
There are so much out there in terms of trying to get connected, right? So we've seen that there's an uptick. And first of all, if you guys are enjoying the conversation, we are live on YouTube, Twitter, and on not LinkedIn.
Facebook.
How can I forget Facebook? Oh, my God. Insanity. But we're live. And if you guys like our conversation, please tag your friends or share and like. And we appreciate all of that. But in terms of the apps that are out there, we've seen that today in the Wall Street Journal, they just said that there was an uptick of over, like, almost, look, I remember the number, so I'm going to tell you, 12.6% in the last quarter. And it's like apparently double what it was like a year ago or so in terms of use of apps. And the ones that they were talking about were Hinge, Tinder, and Bumble. And I'm not sure if you know, but Bumble, I just was watching, in our surgeon's lounge in between cases, people put C-SPAN, MSNBC on. And Bumble's valued at $8.5 billion right now. And so these dating apps, you're like, oh, it's an app. No, it's quite an industry. And really the question is, how are these dating apps helping or hurting in this time, in this pandemic?
Sure. So I can jump in. And I think that what's really interesting about these apps and that there's so many, right? And the good thing is we can think of them as being in competition with each other. But from the perspective of users, they actually have different niches that they can target. So depending on your demographics, right? So if you're looking for something more casual and hookups, there are apps for that. If you're looking for more serious relationships, there are apps for that. If you're looking for dating, if you're 19 versus you're 60, there are different apps for that. And the industry is called online dating, but it encompasses both websites and apps now. And actually apps, more people use the apps. And in fact, some of the companies, the apps are a lot better than the websites in terms of the kind of technological upgrades and updates they've done. The user experience is easier. So we know, and actually for the last 10 years, so I do a big study in my lab at the Kinsey Institute called Singles in America. It's actually a partnership with Match.com. It's funded by Match with my colleague, Helen Fisher. And for 10 years, we ask every year a sample of over 5,000 singles, it's not people on a dating site, where they met their most recent partner. And the number of people who have met online has increased and increased. So people who are using websites and apps. It is now the most common way for singles in America. Over a third of the adult population is single at any given time. Over 100 million adults, at least in the United States, moving in and out of romantic relationships. The most common way for them to meet a romantic partner is the internet, these apps and websites. And to put it in perspective, last year, before COVID times, we found that close to 40% met their partner through the internet in some way, website or apps. Only 6% met at a bar. So this notion that we're kind of going out to parties and bars and clubs and meeting partners, that's not really what bears out in the data. People are meeting on these apps and websites. Now, there's a lot of pros and cons to them. There's, I think, a lot of opportunities that they offer, but there's also some challenges, some serious challenges with some of them. But maybe you want to say something.
It's interesting because I was in the OR a couple of months ago, and there was a device rep in there, young man. You know, like you said, there's difference if you're in your 20s, your 30s, etc. So young guy in his, I think, 20s, maybe 30s, and he had just, associated with somebody on a dating app. And I said, so how are you going to meet her? Like, it was a hookup app. It was not a relationship. He's not looking for marriage type of person at mm-hmm. this point in his life. Yeah. And I said, so where are you guys going to meet? It's COVID. Like, this is well before, you know, vaccines, everything. And he said, oh, I'm going to go to her house. And I thought, geez, if you were my girlfriend, I would tell you, please do not go to his or her house, and you're now my friend who happens to be a boy. And I'm like, I don't know about that. So what happens when you swipe right or do whatever you need to do to engage with somebody? What happens next in the time of COVID? And maybe Bryony, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think what's interesting about this conversation too, and with Justin doing this study for 10 years, is 10 years ago, we thought dating apps were weird, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you were on a dating app, you were kind of like the weird one of the group. Right. Whereas now, if you're not on a dating app, it's like, what are you doing? You're single and you're not on a dating app? Get on it. And to me, that just sort of proves this larger point around sex and technology where, you know, people poo-poo robots or, oh, that's just like crap in the future. It's like, actually, these things assimilate into our society pretty quickly. And now, you know, we think dating apps are the norm. And so sort of just thinking about that into the future and really acknowledging that, like, things like robots aren't that wild and crazy. But bringing it back to today in terms of, like, just the surge of online dating going on right now, what we see is video dating is the new norm. So post that swipe where you're connecting, video dating, and becoming, in terms of like human behavior, becoming dexterous in digital flirting, right? Whether that is sexting and doing that sort of chat, that chatting up someone via text, we're developing these skills pretty well now. And then the art of the video date, how do you create either conversation and questions or do an activity together over video? And then the final thing that people are having to learn pretty quickly, points to that point you made around, well, how do you date in a pandemic? You go over to someone's house. So we're developing new ways of safeguarding ourselves, both digitally, you know, when we think about revenge porn, but also when the dates sort of mingle from going online to offline. And so whether that is texting a friend your location, even using that share location function and creating elements of safety are really, really important. And we do need to become more literate in this side of where sex and technology intersect. So I think that's really interesting. I think that's not going away after the pandemic. I think we're going to continue doing video dates as sort of and FaceTiming people before we even meet on the first date. And I think that's one thing that I think people are using is, I'm going to video chat you before I arrive at your house.
You know, and even that's because when, you know, I used to hear from friends like, yeah, these people put up pictures that are not like, like 10 years ago pictures. So doing a FaceTime is like a best way to like really see what somebody is. Radhika Luxman had a great comment about the concern that use of all this tech is going to replace somewhat human contact. And it, she's right. Human relationships are fragile. And certainly we've seen that with COVID. Or have we, right? You guys did a study on looking at pandemic and seeing if your relationship gets better or worse. We have a slide on that, if we could pop that up. But it's interesting because I would always say that if your relationship was good going in, it'll probably get stronger. But if it was a little bit shaky, that perhaps it might not get better. Justin?
Exactly. And what we saw in the data was that exactly as you said, that there were these amplifying effects because of the pandemic, partly because of the stress. So a lot of people who are in relationships, who are married or in partnerships, they turned towards their partner. They looked at their partner as a source of social support, of connection. That actually relationships reported on average in a lot of the studies so far, including the ones at the Kinsey Institute, that relationships on average reported doing the same are actually improvements. Most people had improvements. Now, there's a subset of people that this was too much. It put them over the top. A lot of those were cases of people, either relationships characterized by some intimate partner violence and domestic violence. You know, it just became too unsafe, too abusive, too problematic, too much discord. You know, IPV in the broad sense isn't always just physical abuse. And then, so there are those relationships, but the vast majority actually said they were doing okay or doing better. But we asked about both sexual activity and relationship factors. And on average, what we found in our big longitudinal study, it's data collected early on, there was a decrease in sexual frequency. So on average, is a multinational study, not restricted to just the US. People reported a decrease in sexual behavior since the start of the pandemic and a decrease in the desire for sexual behavior. And they also reported a decrease in the quality of their sex life. But the relationships weren't necessarily always suffering. The relationship aspects seemed to be weathering the storm, which is really interesting because we know that relationship and sexual satisfaction are highly correlated. They tend to sort of go up and down together. And what we think might be going on, well, and one part that's interesting, when we looked at all the sexual behaviors, that one sort of interesting measure that we used was masturbation. And we asked people in the year before the pandemic, had you ever masturbated? Only a little over 2% of people said no, never. But since the pandemic, it was over 20%. And that's an interesting objective measure of interest in sexual activity, right? It's not the question about whether you had sex in the last year, I think to the case you were saying before about the tech, the rep that you were working with, it maybe is access to partners, right? So if you're single or if you're in a long distance relationship, that can kind of make the data hard to interpret. It might be the access to finding partners. But what we found is it was actually interest. There was a lower interest in sex. And the way I like to think about it is, you would never see two gazelle mate in front of a lion, right? If we're in a fear state or if we're in a flight state, that is not, it's not conducive to sociality, and it's especially not conducive to sexuality and relationship function. So those require some sense of safety. It's why we talk, why relationship therapists always say things about, you know, you need a partner that you feel safe with and comfortable with. If you go on dates and you're really uncomfortable, especially now in COVID, if you have a date and wants to go out to a restaurant and you're not comfortable with that, it's not going to be a good date, right? That's not, a little bit of stress can be exciting. Too much tips you over the edge. It's not conducive for sociality.
I like Elizabeth Forbes Wallace's comment. She said, first of all, when she texts, she can actually get a word in edgewise and she can think about it and not walk away saying, I should have said this. And then she said, maybe we are just substituting sex for quality time, and we're actually having more quality time. So what do you think about that, Bryony?
Yeah, like sex as a surrogate for intimacy.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I think, this is why COVID has been so interesting, because it's opened up this conversation about what is sex and sexuality or intimacy. And the thing is, sex, sexuality, intimacy is so many different things beyond the physical. It's not just about an orgasm. It's these other dimensions, like the emotional intimacy of a conversation, intellectual intimacy, spiritual intimacy, or doing activities together. So I think when the physical side of intimacy is removed, we're forced to look at all these other areas that so often get ignored because the physical is so obvious. So that's how I agree with that. And I think we're getting better at that. I also have noticed, to point to Justin's thing about masturbation, is thank goodness people are talking about it now and it's becoming more normal, and we're seeing even celebrities, or if you turn on Instagram, you see people sort of influencing vibrators, which we hadn't seen really that much before the pandemic hit. So people are spending a lot more time at home and thinking and being more adventurous, whether they're couples or they're at home and then buying that first sex toy. I think that's a positive. Now, whether or not they're using it, I'm saying 20% more people are masturbating or have tried masturbating, we're still unsure, but people are certainly having the conversation, which is great, whether that's in mainstream forums or with their friends. And they're also, with their purchasing behavior, we're seeing they're buying it. Whether or not they're using it, that's another story, I think, in terms of the creating that time for yourself. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, we have a slide of you giving a discussion. So one, you know, here's the Kinsey Institute saying marriage is better, and then what we thought is everyone's like, in 9 months we're going to have COVID babies, right? And so Riley did a podcast talking about this with Sid Murthy. If you want to just talk a little about this.
Wow, I love that you're digging up my my internet treasures that I've almost forgotten about. But yeah, I think what we were talking about there is, you know, there is so much hype around people saying, oh, it's going to be a baby boom. And what we were saying there is actually it might not be. You know, people, exactly what Justin was saying, people are probably more stressed and can't afford to have a baby and all these things. So actually that hype headline, that clickbaity headline, may be totally off. Maybe people don't want to go to the hospital, and so they're deciding, no, I'm not going to have a baby, and that prediction of a boom is actually the opposite. We're still yet to see that. And in terms of divorce, you know, very early on in the pandemic, we were following this in China and looking at the rates of divorce going up. I'm not sure if you have any research on the US, but as we were saying before, when you spend that much time with someone, even if you adore them, little things start to get on, you know, grind your gears a bit. And it's really important, right, Justin, to carve out that personal time.
I love that. And I think you're so good at predicting the future. You're way better at it than I am. So, and I think I totally agree. I think the data that we're seeing now supports it. We know, I talked to one woman who participated in one of our studies, and she said, you know, she and her husband from her perspective, they have a great relationship, but he always traveled for half the week. And she said, I just realized he doesn't approve of the stuff I used to do for half the week when he was gone. You know, she'd go out one night, she'd get a babysitter for the kids. Their relationship, she said, it was always good and nice. We still love each other, but we're not meant to be in a house together for 7 days a week. That's not what they signed up for, and it actually didn't work for them. So they were having this unexpected discord. The part about the baby boom, you're so right. And I think, so demographers have studied this in other contexts. And what we know is that small stressors, so in the case of natural disasters, small things can lead to a boom 9 or 10 months later. But larger, like a hurricane warning or a small tropical storm, you see a baby boom 9 or 10 months later. And the idea is that it's a little bit of stress and it makes you turn to your partner and say, life is short, what are we doing? Let's just, you know, let's celebrate each other and do this. But bigger things, a full-on hurricane, things like Katrina, we don't see baby booms 9, 10 months later. And it also in acts of violence. So in the Oklahoma City bombing, 9 to 10 months later, there was a baby boom. September 11th in New York City, no baby boom in the next year. So these short, smaller stressors seem to have some effect on fecundity and fertility outcomes, but not necessarily these bigger ones. And I think COVID's just too big. I think for all the reasons Bryony said, right, it's a concern about the economy, about going to a hospital, when this is going to be over. I don't think we'll see that. The divorce pattern is interesting. I think we'll probably see this little peak that happens in part because of people who are like waiting to go to the court and fill out the paperwork. Or financially, divorce is expensive. That's the thing that I want to talk about.
When we talked about the baby boom early on, the joke was, it's all going to be first-time parent baby boom. It's not going to be those who already have kids. It's not happening because we know better.
So I think I will never forget, you will never see two gazelles mating in front of a lion. So I appreciate that little wisdom. We have some interesting comments. And as you know, we're live on social media, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter. We are carried by WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and WBAI.org on Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. And you can always catch our shows on our channels on YouTube and Facebook if you happen to miss this one. There's a lot of wisdom being thrown at us and a lot of interesting ideas, so I hope you let your friends know. James says, matchmakers are having a comeback. And I remember, you know, moving here from India in 1969 and knowing that matchmakers existed, and then watching Fiddler on the Roof wasn't actually very strange to me. But then all my friends here thought that was really weird. And now we're seeing, you know, shows about matchmaking and sort of safer avenues to meet people. And Rambana says that she thinks that the tech actually makes it safer. So that you can actually almost, as you guys were saying, pre-screen or let your friends know where you're going to be, or sort of, you know, share my location. And that segues to a very difficult topic. So I want to warn our viewers and our listeners that we will be talking about violence, and particularly violence among, against women, for the next few minutes. But we unfortunately are seeing an uptick technology, not just for sexuality and for relationships, but we are seeing it to combat the violence that is being experienced by a large subset of people, often but not limited to women. And maybe, Bryony, we can talk through a bit of some of the technology that's been developed for this. We have a few examples for you to discuss, if you don't mind.
Great. Yeah. I mean, we can start with sort of, let's ease ourselves in with one of the easiest things, I think, is talking about dating apps. And we see, you know, just dating in general, there's a level of harassment towards women that is unfortunate. And Ghostbot is a really interesting app. You can go to their website or Google Ghostbot, and it's basically allows you to ghost an unwanted advance on a dating app. When things sort of turn sour, or, you know, this person is just continues to harass after you say no, you can employ Ghostbot, and Ghostbot then manages the conversation for you, and you don't have to see that again. So they very, you know, eloquently and gracefully exit the conversation, but you don't have to do the emotional labor of getting someone off your back. So I think that's a really interesting light app in terms of figuring out how do you get out of these unwanted interactions, and that idea of, can harassment, sexual harassment, exist online, and is it as powerful as in person? And I would argue, yeah, it is. So then we have, you know, moving into other areas, which are just so many different applications, often apps that are designed to help with sexual harassment reporting or detection. So you can see here, there's a list of all different sorts of ones that are being used at the moment. Callisto in the US is a really important and popular one, developed a few years ago, and it was designed for on-campus reporting of sexual assault, which we know is a huge problem in the US, and designed to improve the experience. Often the experience is honestly really awful, and it deters people from reporting their assault. And Callisto aimed to improve that through just a more streamlined experience, a better user experience, which goes a long way and helps you set you up with the right resources as well to access afterwards, which, you know, personally speaking, and being in university eons ago and experiencing the same myself and having to fill out papers and stuff, I just felt it was a really awful and not supportive experience. So Callisto has now moved from on-campus reporting to workplace reporting as well. It also matches up, you know, whoever you're reporting, if that's detected in the system already in the database. So those sorts of things improve, unfortunately, an experience that is often awful anyway. And then we have things that happen in different countries, which I also find really interesting, looking at how technology manifests in different cultures according to those needs. So we have in Iran, where the level of domestic violence is 2/3 of women in marriages experience that. They have an app called Toranj, and it connects you to education, legal resources, calling, you know, security, or also friends if that's not a not an option for you to call police. You can see there we've got the invisible ink stamp that was developed in Japan after women, particularly high school girls, were getting flashed or having unwanted sort of sexual harassment in the subways. The telecommunications company developed this in UV stamp, essentially, where you would go and stamp the perpetrator and that would identify them to others. It cost about $20, so fairly low price point, and it sold out within a couple of hours. Now, thinking about the user behavior around that, would we or would I use a stamp after someone, you know, did something unpleasant? Probably not. But I think these are sort of interesting innovations in how we're combating sexual harassment and violence using technologies like this. The final one I was going to mention was the Rape Axe prototype out of South Africa. South Africa, the current statistics I'm not 100% sure on, but I do know when I was looking into it, it was rape occurs every once in 17 seconds, which is a really tough statistic to get your head around. And they developed a female condom, which is fitted with barbs, and that's designed. There we go. There it is, anti-rape condom. It's still in prototype, but it's actually come a long way and got a lot of funding last year to be able to, you can sort of order a prototype now. It's designed to sit inside the vagina and lock onto a penis if someone was to attempt that, and then they'd have to go to hospital to get it removed. Obviously, with all these sorts of technologies and innovations, there's a ton of ethical considerations and implications that have to be thought through, and it's a bit of a wild west at the moment, I will say. There's no sex tech ethics committee out there, but it really is interesting looking at how these things pop up in different cultures according to different needs.
You know, the other problem is that we keep, you know, a lot of the tech that you described is women coming up with these different ideas because they're trying to save themselves and others. Is that we just cannot change rape culture. Like it is, it's that's the most disappointing thing, is that all the things that I would do to make sure that I'm safe. I grew up in New York City in the 70s, okay? The 80s weren't much better. And, you know, where you walk, what time it is, like I would never, even to this day, and it's much safer now, I'm not walking through Central Park at like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm just asking for trouble. Why would I do that? But why, if I wanted to and I couldn't sleep, why shouldn't I be able to do that, right? But you can't, because you're putting yourself at risk. And how, if there's technology out there that grabs photos of people or fingerprints them automatically or does any of that for someone who's assaulting you, and, you know, the thing about the Japanese and that ink stamp, it's because in their culture they're not going to scream and yell and make a scene, right? Because that they're taught not to do in their culture. This is a more subtle way of stamping somebody, but it's still so weird that it happens. Mm. And that's called frotterism, when you feel somebody, I guess, in a subway. It's just dreadful that that happens. I remember just a quick story. Sujana went to school with my sister, Ray, and once he was in the, you know, the subway, it gets crowded, everyone's there. Somebody grabbed her butt. My sister had nails. She reached back and she just demolished that person's hand, you know, and I'm sure he let go in a hurry, and that there was, you know, bleeding. There had to be, because she had strong nails. I know, I was on the receiving end sometimes too, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a.
Yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard to know what to react at that time when something's happening. Women, as we know, homosexual men, people are not taken seriously when they say that things have happened to them. You know, even in that graphic we showed, the bra that was created by three engineering students in India that delivers 82, I don't know why 82, electric shocks when somebody tries to attack you. They actually thought about it. They were going to put it in panties, but they realized that the sexual assault usually began at the breast. And, you know, this is horrible, right? It's horrible that we're thinking about this. There's a picture from Japan of a woman whose dress turns into a mock-up of a vending machine. So if you're afraid, you go and kind of lift up your dress and become, like, merge into the wall as a vending machine, which kind of sounds like Maxwell Smart invented it. But it's something that really shouldn't have to be. You had talked to us about violence in general with dating. Any difference between using apps and not using apps? Are we seeing any increase or decrease safety when we're using hookup apps or relationship apps, Justin?
Sure. So I think you're exactly right, right? These are numbers that we shouldn't have to contend with. And it's the unfortunate reality that women and women and also sexual and gender minorities in so many places are dealing with, and they've continued to have to deal with for long periods of time. So some of our projects deal with these issues of sexual harassment, particularly in business environments, and also sexual assault. We study sexual assault, in particular on college campuses, military, kind of those confined spaces. And one of the things we know is that exactly that. So what we call sexual misconduct is the sort of larger term to include intimate partner violence, rape, sexual assault, stalking. And so this sexual misconduct was occurring, it has been occurring for a long time. And we see it happening on these apps of these technologies. I think we have to be a little bit cautious of what the causal mechanisms are here. So what we know about a lot of this harassment, assault, it was happening before the technologies. And I think exactly as Briani said really nicely, there are technologies that are happening that can help address that. Now, that same kind of harassment has moved to the apps. It's not that the apps created it. And there's some really interesting things. So coincidentally, both Bumble and Match are the Match Group, the parent company of Match.com, are both headquartered in Texas. And Texas has had some legislation in the U.S. of trying to make it a crime if you send, for instance, an unsolicited genital image, which is a dick pic, as it's called, on these apps, which a lot of men are doing, right? So we did a study on that and looked, and actually a lot of the men who do it, women overall say, what are their top reactions? They're grossed out. They feel disrespected. When we asked men, why are you doing it? Both straight men and gay men and bisexual men. They said, well, to be playful because I thought she wanted it or he wanted it. So it's what we call a sexual misattribution, a bias, where in the case where, particularly in the case of men and women doing it, that there's just a fundamental misunderstanding of why one is doing it versus the other, right? A lot of these guys are sending it. They don't realize how offensive it is. They don't realize how much, that in some cases it's a crime. It should be considered a crime. So there's, in some cases at the harassment level, there's that. We then ramp up to intimate partner violence and sexual assault. I mean, in that case, they've got to realize what they're doing is a problem. And I think that the technologies both, it's both. We're seeing that they have possible responses on how to deal with it and ways to make people feel safer, particularly women. But it's also in some ways amplifying the violence that was occurring in the world around us anyway, the sexual violence, gender violence in particular. So I think that there's both, it's a difficult conversation to have, but there's both really positive and negatives associated with this. And as we go into the data, we can kind of see that. At the same time, we look at some of the apps, for instance, certain groups like sexual and gender minorities, gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, they use dating apps at much higher rates than heterosexuals because it's safer than going on a date or going into a bar and trying to pick someone up. Maybe it's fine in New York, Miami, Chicago, but in many other places in the world, that's not, if you're a gay guy or a lesbian woman, it's not particularly safe to walk into a bar and date. So I think we have to be really careful when we think about safe for who. Dating has a lot of risks in general. And I think the idea is that these technologies can and they should try and provide some mechanisms to make it a little bit easier, a little bit safer. Going back to the video dating that Briani said before, I'm convinced, I agree with you, I'm totally on board. I think video dating is here to stay. I think it's a new step in the courtship process. Exactly for this reason, you get to learn a lot more about someone before you really go meet them, more of the sensory experience.
We're a little bit running out of time. What are some of the takeaways? No, I think all this is fantastic. What are some takeaways you want to leave with our listeners?
Oh, gosh. Brandon, you go first. You're more articulate with these things.
Oh, no, I'm not. Don't be silly. It's been such a pleasure to be with you guys. I mean, there's a ton of learnings here, but I think my passion is sex tech, and I just implore everyone not to be afraid of technology and using it, but remembering technology is a tool. I saw some comments there really around the fear of technology replacing us, whether that's a full rip and replace as a robot girlfriend or boyfriend, or replacing a sense of intimacy or touch, or those sorts of things. And humans are so special. That's sort of what makes intimacy amazing, is the creativity, the imagination, the spontaneity, humanity of just being a human, right? So I don't think we're ever going to be fully replaced. We can't be. So how can technology help you rather than hinder you, you know? And I think we all are suckers for getting stuck on social media and sort of doing the brain drain. So being mindful about it, but also being curious, like, is there something new you want to try? Or could you, you know, look at different toys that have interesting technologies? And rather than being afraid of it, let's be open to it and think about the potential. And that might be in your own life, in your own pleasure or prevention. It can also mean as a business, which is what I help people with, because there is so much potential if we draw on our own experiences, as you've seen there, the rape apps or the sexual violence apps, they came from somebody's personal experience as much as the latest innovation in sex toys or an app for dating. So what in your own experience do you want to improve? And could technology help be the vehicle for that? So don't be afraid of technology. And also, you know, coming back to this world that we're living in today where we're completely saturated with technology, let's turn it off occasionally, right? And give the gift of presence to someone without all those distractions and that noise in the background.
When we could all be together again. Thank you guys so much for joining us again. I want to thank Justin Garcia, as the director of the Kinsey Institute of Indiana University. He's also a professor of gender studies there. And Bryony, you've been perfect, leading expert on sex tech, the future of sex podcast. And she's also a sexpert on Love Honey, the website, and works with the company. And you guys, we want to thank our team, because without them, we wouldn't be able to put the show on for you guys. Both Suju and I are excited. We will be back next week. And we're just solidifying our guests for next week, but it'll be a great show. So look for the tweets about Wednesday when we get the show all ready. Thanks so much.
Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Happy Valentine's Day, Marina.
Happy Valentine's Day.